You're now in the huddle with Coach Calls Timeout, the podcast that dissects the mind of a different basketball coach every episode. We uncover what makes them successful and how their story translates to your coaching journey. Let's unlock your team's potential together. Welcome to episode 23 of the Coach Calls Timeout podcast. Dan Jonker here. Here at Coach Calls Timeout, we're a basketball coaching resource. If you're a coach and you need a few plays or drills, check us out at coachcallstimeout.com. We have something that nobody else does. All our plays and drills are in video format. No still shots. And they can be downloaded directly to your laptop, phone, or tablet. All the videos are small enough files that you can send them to your players to use as a study guide, or you can use them during practices or timeouts. We have a special offer for you, the podcast listener. Just go to coachcallstimeout.com right after this episode, and when you're signing up to become a member, just use the coupon code PODCAST, and you'll receive a free 7-day trial to sample every video we have to offer. One of my intentions for 2017 is to focus on the positive more often. I have a tendency to think about the negative of a situation before anything else, and I'm trying to retrain my brain to be more positive. So when my 1.5-year-old daughter spills her water while she's trying to drink out of a cup, instead of thinking about the mess and worrying about the table and chairs and floors getting wet, I'm going to take a second and reflect on the positive. She's practicing her hand-eye coordination. She's learning about gravity and that her dad has patience and that spilling water isn't such a big deal. So what does this have to do with today's episode, you may be asking? Today we have someone on the show that many coaches struggle to have a positive relationship with. We have a Hall of Fame referee who's worked hundreds of NCAA games and worked with the biggest coaching names in the business. He even reffed Michael Jordan's first game at North Carolina. Ron Foxcroft joins the show to describe the referee's role and how to make the relationship as respectful, constructive, and as positive as possible. I truly believe this conversation will change the way you view the coach-referee relationship. He also shares some great stories from his decades of experience. As usual, at the end of this episode, we have another great story from Coach Steve Konchalski in the latest installment of Storytime with the Canadian Coach K. My brother Brian handles the interview with Ron Foxcroft. Let's get right to it. Brian Jonker here with you for episode 23 of the Coach Calls Timeout podcast. To date, we have had coaches and assistant coaches from the NBA, the NCAA, the CIS, the CCAA. Today we're going to take a completely different approach, and we're going to look at the coach-referee perspective and the relationship, and we're going to do it with arguably the most recognized official in the history of Canadian basketball, and I'm speaking of Ron Foxcroft, who's with us today. And Ron, of course, is the chairman and founder and CEO of Fox 40 International, and he also refereed for many decades. Ron, I really appreciate you taking some time out of your busy schedule today to talk basketball with us.
Brian, it's a pleasure, especially to talk to you, being such an accomplished coach. You know, in our business, our business of basketball that we love so much, it's all about mutual respect. And I respect what you've done as a coach, and I respect everybody that coaches young men and tries to craft our future leaders.
Well, the respect is mutual in what you've accomplished and what you've done over the years. Tell our listeners how you actually got into officiating.
Well, it was really funny. I was a lousy student at Waterdown High School, and I was just there basically to play football and to play basketball. And I injured my back. I was a quarterback in high school, really enjoyed it, injured my back. And back then, a long, long time ago, there wasn't the medical science that's available today. The doctor would simply tape your back and say, now either go out and play or sit in the bench. It wasn't very scientific. And the bottom line, I couldn't play football anymore, couldn't play basketball. So I had a friend that had refereed my basketball games at Waterdown High School, said to me one day, he said, you know, have you ever thought of refereeing? And I said, well, I've umpired a little bit of baseball. But he said, let's go to the class in Hamilton and we'll teach you how to referee basketball. And I said, Frank, his name was Frank Buchanan. I said, Frank, I don't have a car. And if I had a car, I don't have gas money to get to the class. He said, I'll drive you. So I'm always indebted to a gentleman from Burlington named Frank Buchanan, who drove me to the Hamilton Basketball Referees Board's classes a long time ago. And you know, I really loved it. I didn't like school, but I liked the classes associated with the game of basketball. One of the things about being a basketball referee, and I say it's predominant, you have to love the game. You really have to love the game, because staying in basketball, there's a lot of challenges as a referee. There's a lot of abuse. There's a lot of parental abuse. And we lose 65% of our referees in year three just because of that, the abuse, the challenges, the difficulty. There's really no money in it. There's no money in Canada after you buy your equipment and take your training and buy your rule book and so on. You know, it turns out to be a break even and a great sacrifice, like it is for a coach away from your family. It's a lot of time away. So anyway, I was 17 years old, got into refereeing, and my very first game was a CYO game in Hamilton. I got paid 75 cents, and Tom Gallagher, just a wonderful, wonderful person associated with the game of basketball, came up to me after the game, paid me my 75 cents, and said, we want change because you're rotten and you're never going to make it. And that turned out to be probably the turning point in my life, because I said to myself, you know, I'm going to take that challenge. He said, I'm never going to make it. I'm rotten. I'm not good enough. I am going to work hard. And my mom and dad always said to me when I left school, you don't have to be seen as the smartest guy in the neighborhood. You have to be seen as the hardest working guy in the neighborhood. And I worked very, very hard. Within a year, I became the youngest Canadian to join the OUA referees panel when I got hired by Kitch McPherson. And by the time I turned 21, I had worked what was then, Brian, the CIAU.
Wow.
It's now U Sport.
Yes.
It's been CIS. Anyway, I worked in the finals of the CIAU basketball championship.
At the age of 21?
At the age of 21.
Wow.
And then I just absolutely, but the motivation, to be really honest, love for the game. I just loved watching great basketball players hone their skills. It was just an amazing love for the game, which resulted in a great love for the game of basketball refereeing. And I would be remiss to say, in Hamilton, we had great mentors. My one, of course, was the famous, the best referee that ever came out of Canada, Kitch McPherson. And he was a tough taskmaster and brought along great officials out of Hamilton, like Guy Cipriani, Len Parisi, Mario Cefaletta, Bob Wilmot, Jim Lyle, and so on and so on. So I had great mentors, but also a great love for the game.
At 21, to get a game of that magnitude, the respect that the people must have had for your work ethic and what you had done in that short period of time must have been immense, because, I mean, like anything, you kind of have to pay your dues, and especially to get a game of that magnitude. There was probably some older officials that might not have been too happy with having this 21-year-old do a game like that.
That's a good point, but also there were some officials, some older officials that were mentors that were really happy for me, and my partner in the game was a fellow in Hamilton named Len Parisi. And I remember when they played the national anthem, I was scared to death. My legs were like spaghetti. And he turned to me and he said, you'll be less nervous if you sing the national anthem. And he turned to me after the national anthem and he said, you do the running and I'll do the talking. So I really didn't have to worry. It's the game's a lot different now. I didn't have to worry about anything except calling the plays, get the out of bounds right, get the shooting fouls right, and run like heck to get in the right position so you got the best angle. As a referee, you don't necessarily have to be the closest to the play. You have to have what's called the best angle and the best position. So it was easy. It was a two-person game back then. But he said, you do the running and I'll do the talking. So if there was any problems, I knew, I had the confidence that Lenny would take care of things. The other thing is I learned very quickly, and this is really important. A, mutual respect. Mutual respect from the referee to the coaches. The coaches are out there for many reasons, but particularly they love the game. And we're there as basketball referees, and one of the main reasons is we love the game. So I learned very early that there must be and there has to be mutual respect. The other thing I learned, and Brian, this may surprise some coaches, other than the 40 minutes of the game, which are important, requires 100% concentration, 100% awareness, 100% focus. But something that we talk about in our business of basketball officiating, the pregame conference with your crew and the postgame conference. And I'll define that by saying, you know, a good pregame gets your head into the game so you have the right attitude going into that game and you get that 100% necessary concentration and focus to go in the game. If your concentration level or focus level in a basketball game is 99%, that is unacceptable. You cannot have any other thing on your mind when you're refereeing a 40-minute basketball game other than that game and delivering what the players and coaches expect, and that is 100% effort, 100% concentration and focus. The other thing that's very important that surprises people is your post-game conference. I used to love working, especially when I went down to the States and ended up working in 9 conferences. I loved working with the Dr. Nichols of the world and John Clockerty's of the world and some of the great officials, because their post-game conference ended up to be a clinic on basketball officiating. And what they would do, the good crew chiefs, they'd come into the locker room after the game and they wouldn't say, oh, we did a great job. Wasn't that a great game? Let's go out and grab a Coke or an adult beverage. They would say, as soon as we got into the locker room, what could we have done better? What could we have done better? And what plays would we like to look at? And of course, later in my career, every game I ever did, I did 75 a year, was on TV. So you had the luxury of always having a tape. Early in my career, you didn't have that luxury because there wasn't such a thing as a game tape that was readily available to you. So, you know, something in officiating, post-game conference. You do it as a coach and we do it as a referee. That turns out to be an amazing, amazing learning experience.
I mean, you touched on so many different things there, but it's unbelievable. If someone just joined in the middle of the conversation and didn't realize that we were talking with Ron Foxcroft, the basketball official, if they joined in 30 seconds in there, they might have thought we had a coach on the line, because all the things that you're talking about are the same types of things that we preach. Communicating, self-evaluation, preparation, concentration, giving a full effort. I mean, all the things that you just mentioned are the same things that as coaches we preach to our players. It's interesting.
It's exactly the same, Brian. I'm glad you said that, because, you know, to have a good basketball game, you need terrific coaches, terrific referees, terrific players, and terrific administrators and so on. Like, there can't be a weak link in the chain. And yes, we think just like coaches. Now most coaches realize that the referees are out there trying to do a perfect job, and there's no such a thing. You know, the first game you go out and referee, you want to be perfect, and then you want to get better after that. But we're trying, our goals are the same as you, Brian. You're striving every single time for that perfect game, and you want to get the best 100% effort out of your players. We want the same thing from our crew. And also too, you know, in my latter years, more my last 10 or 15 years, every game was a 3-person crew. So you live with that crew and you die with that crew. And if your partner got into trouble, you also got into trouble because you were a team just like your team, just like the 5 players on the team. What you strive for, I know at Mohawk College is team chemistry, team chemistry. You don't necessarily have to have the 5 best players in the country. What you have to have is the best chemistry. We strive for the very, very same thing. And that comes from an amazing pregame, an amazing postgame. I did a game in the NCAA, and it was down in Arizona, and I think it was the Running Rebels from Las Vegas, Nevada, and Steve Smith, who's now on TV from Michigan State. And it was nearly a perfect game because Don Rutledge was my crew chief, a famous guy that worked many Final Fours. His pregame was 40 minutes long, and me and my crewmate Dave Dodge and Don Rutledge, we went out on that floor, and we were ready. We were 100% ready to give the players and the coaches what they deserve, 100% good effort by us.
So how many years did you spend, you were in the Big Ten there for a long time, were you not?
Yes, I was.
And how long did you spend in the Big Ten?
I spent, I believe, about 10. Altogether, in my 9 conferences, I spent 25 years in the Big Ten, and I saw some amazing coaches. I meant 25 years in the NCAA, and I saw some amazing coaches. And, you know, Brian, you hear the term working the referees.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a reality. And let me tell you how referees think. Number one, you go into a game, and no matter what happens, the next time you do that team or that coach, for me, it was a new world. Everything was erased from my mind. It was a clean slate. It was a new world. But a couple things that coaches need to understand. The yappers, the complainers, the coaches that want every call, there's no such a thing as getting every call. And it's not a personal thing. Like referees, basketball is too fast a game to think. As a referee, you don't think. You strategize and you react. So when coaches say, oh, you know, the refs are against me, the calls are going my way, the calls aren't going my way, and you get a lot, some coaches that are yappers and they don't listen when they ask a question to the referee, when the referee comes over. Our philosophy is if a coach asks politely in a businesslike way without trying to center out the referee, we instruct our referees, and this goes to the NCAA and the NBA, give the coach an ear. And one of the best coaches at doing that respectfully, and he was a good guy to work, was my friend Dean Smith from North Carolina. And you know, if Dean questioned a call, then you know there had to be something there, and lend him an ear. And that's important. That's really important. And that's called respect, Brian. And it's earned. It's earned. So coaches have to understand, don't question every call. don't go looking for every call, but there is that call that you know, and probably the referee knows that he's kicked it. He or she, the referee, has kicked it. And there's a way to discuss it during the game. And we always tell our officials, if you think you kicked a call, and, you know, we're big on decorum and sportsmanship. And if I'm refereeing at Mohawk College and I know I kicked a call and you know I kicked a call, and you come up to me at the right moment and we have a dialogue, I might say to you, you know something, Brian? I kicked one, but I'm going to make sure I don't kick another one. Like, you don't walk around making 62 calls a game and saying to the coach at Mohawk College, Brian, you know, I kicked 59 of them.
No, I hope not.
No, exactly. Now, when I was at Mohawk College, Wes Hicks thought I kicked 59 out of the 62. And I think he actually banned me from Mohawk College. I had to go to Mohawk College under an assumed name for about 25 years until Jonesy spoke to the president, Mr. McCurley, and when I got my honorary degree at Mohawk, they allowed me back on campus. But, Brian, there's a way for referees to talk to coaches, and it's all about decorum and sportsmanship and professionalism. And, you know, when a coach asks a referee in a very business-like, sportsman-like manner a question, the referee should give the coach an ear. I don't like these referees that run away from coaches, because coaches deserve and earn the respect of the referees. So we're all in this thing together. And that's when we started this interview, I made reference to mutual respect. We need to study what the coach's goals are in that game, and then the coaches in turn have to study what the referee's goals are in that game and develop that mutual respect. Now, that makes for a tremendous basketball game, because really and truly, Brian, I know you coach for the enjoyment of the basketball game and, of course, provide leadership to the players that you're coaching. Referees are the same thing. Referees are there to enjoy the game of basketball. And I always say, if you don't enjoy the game as a referee, don't referee. Get out.
I think it would shine through, and people would see that too. I mean, you can't fake it. So
you can't fake it. No.
I mean, I think one of my strengths, although I may appear out of control once in a while, I'm actually never out of control. Most of what I do is with a purpose. So even if I'm kind of giving it to you guys a little bit, I'd like to think I know what I'm doing. I'm not, once in a while there'll be an appearance that I'm trying to get a technical or whatever, and that's usually what's happening. And there's reasons behind it. I had a guy once in Arizona we were playing, and he was a good NCAA official. And we were playing there about 4 or 5 years ago. And geez, I didn't think things were going our way. And I was really upset. And I got a couple of the guys in that crew that just wouldn't communicate at all. And it just upset me more. But this veteran guy, he'd come over and he'd talk to me through, free throws or something like that. But he'd do it in a slow and methodical way. And he's talking, so I couldn't interrupt him. And then he'd go, I got to go. And he'd run away. Yeah. So he kind of calmed things a little bit. And then I got upset a little bit later. And finally he comes over. He said, listen, I know what you're doing, but you can say whatever you want. I'm not going to throw you out tonight. He goes, so you can decide now to just continue to yell. He goes, but I'm not going to throw you out. So why don't we just have a good time and get through this? And I respect the guy that A, will come over and admit he made a mistake, as long as he's not making 59 of them in a game and admitting to all of them.
Yeah.
And B, is willing to come over and have a conversation with you at the right times during the game without interrupting necessarily the game. I mean, it's pretty hard to argue with someone who isn't arguing. You know, another guy came over to me the other day. I'm giving him grief up in Toronto. He walks over to me at a free throw and he goes, you know what? I missed that. I made a mistake. Well, I can't yell at him. How do I? He just admitted he screwed up. What do I do? Keep yelling at him because he admitted it?
That's exactly when the referee says, and you say you kicked it, he says, you know, coach, you could be right. There's no debate. There's no joining the debating club there. That's a good official. Also, too, Brian, you brought up something very important. There's nothing wrong with an earned professional technical foul to give a signal to your game, to your players in that game. You're in the game, and you're fighting for them. There's nothing wrong with that as long as it's done in a professional way. And I'll tell you, I had that situation happen, and this is a very good, very short story. But I was doing a really tough game. Doc Thomas was coaching down in Windsor.
I played for him for a year.
Amazing man. I still talk to him today. He's 84 years old. I love the man. And anyway, 8 minutes into the game, he's given me a little bit of grief, but it's planned. He's given a signal to his players. Things aren't going too good. He's in the game, and they better get their head into the game. And I had to bust him with a technical foul. 3 minutes later, during a dead ball, he very quietly came over to me, and he said, "Ron, you know something? You're a good referee, but you don't seem to be 100% focused in this game." And I turned to him at that time, and I said, "Doc, you could be right. He nailed it. He nailed it. I was more concentrating and worrying about my flight the next day to referee a game in Philadelphia than I was to referee the rest of that game." So here we go. We're early in the game. I have to bust him with a technical foul. 3 minutes later, there's respect from him, and he quietly, so nobody could see it, said, "Ron, I don't think you're emotionally concentrating 100% on this game." I gave my head a shake, and it ended up to be just an outstanding game of basketball. And I credit that with Doc Thomas recognizing that, but handling it the way you should, with decorum and professionalism. And that's how, that once again, we keep going back to the common denominator, Brian, mutual respect. And you got that out in Arizona. The coach and the referee, he saw what was going on, and he lent you an ear, and that's called calming down period, calming down. And the best person at that is Dick Bavetta. You notice Dick Bavetta in a game. He refereed at the NBA Finals right up until he was 74 years of age. And you know what? When the coach was irate, he would walk over to him and say, "Coach, I need to handle something at the scorer's table, and I'll be right back to lend you an ear." He didn't have to handle anything at the scorer's table. It was called a calming down gap. So he would go over and fake handling an administrative matter at the scorer's table. 2 minutes later, go to the coach and say, "Now, coach, I'm all ears. Let's chat." By then, the coach had calmed down because basketball, you know, it's such an intense game. And your emotions can go from 100 degrees to 0 degrees in 10 seconds.
That's a lot of experience there. And very good crisis management. Maybe he should be he should be one of those guys that talk people down off of the buildings or something like that.
Absolutely. If you've ever heard Dick Bavetta speak, I'll tell you, it's a wonder. We had him in Hamilton last May, and we had 225 people in the room. He didn't have any notes, and he just captured the room as he spoke. But that's, you know, from 40 years of refereeing basketball at the highest level. You can take a lot of life skills that you learn as a basketball referee and a basketball coach, and you can transfer them into real life, into your business, into your family, and into your life.
That's exactly what we say with sport in general as coaches, too. All the young men that I coach, I mean, the lessons are all transferable to life. And I, in my other job, my other day job, I hire a lot of team sport athletes for exactly that reason. They understand how to work as a group. They understand how to set goals. They understand how to self-evaluate and to improve, how to accept criticism. Some are leaders. I mean, there's just so many great qualities that come out of sport. And it's really interesting to listen to you from the other side speak about all those same types of things. It's really interesting.
Exactly. They are life transferable skills. And one of the most important things, and there's many things, attributes that make a great official. You know that, but it's the ability to accept constructive criticism. And I know we're on the time clock here, but when I refereed the Olympic gold medal game in Montreal, I felt pretty good. I came home to Hamilton, and my mentor, Kitch McPherson, invited me over to his kitchen, and he spent 2 hours critiquing my work in the Olympic gold medal game.
1976, right?
1976. Number one, he forbade me to get a swelled head, and he said, you know what? Life is life learning, and you may have got the Olympic gold medal game, but I have a lot of things that I want to constructively criticize you for the way you handled that game. And you know something? I sat there for 2 hours, and I appreciated that because he could have just said, if he didn't care, he could have said, you know, you got the Olympic gold medal game. What are you going to do next? But he didn't. He said, you've got to get better. And that's why I still know his phone number. You know, we're going back to 1976. I still have his phone number, 522-6591, and he's been deceased for 10 years. But that's how much he meant to me. And you really have to, as a coach and as a referee, we have a common denominator here. We have to have that ability to accept constructive criticism.
Now, we've got a lot of young coaches that listen to the podcast here, and maybe they're just starting out and they're looking for tips and those types of things on how to coach youth teams. You rise to a certain level. You know, if I'm at the college level, for example, the referees I'm going to get are typically experienced people who deserve to be at the college level. When you referee youth or when you coach youth games, you'll typically get guys who probably deserve to be doing the youth games for the most part. They're either up and coming and very, very young. Might be in their teens like you were when you started, to maybe people who can't necessarily get up and down the floor like they used to with, you know, a men's team or a college team.
Right.
For young coaches out there, parents who are helping out, what one piece of advice can you give from an official standpoint to make the games a little bit easier and the tension? I mean, I've sat in gyms because I've coached my daughter's teams, grade 5, 6, 7, and 8 the last 4 years as well.
Yeah.
And the hostilities in some of those small gyms with parents who really don't understand the game very well and grandparents, and, you know, everybody's out and screaming and yelling, and it's really quite chaotic. From an official standpoint, what could the coaches do to help in those cases? Leave them alone and understand they're, you know, just starting out or just ending their careers or whatever it is?
You know what these young coaches, and I know what you mean, I remember working, I worked Michael Jordan's first game, and I was in Chapel Hill working that game, and, you know, there was, it was back in Carmichael Hall then, so there was about 16,000 people on a Saturday night, and there was 10,000 people trying to get into the stadium because of this young boy named Mike from Wilmington, North Carolina, which was Michael Jordan, and, I came back to Hamilton and worked a midget high school game, which was more chaotic, more abuse with the parents and with the kids. And you know what? A good advice there is for the coaches, pick your spots. Don't make a scene. Ask a question. Practice decorum. Practice sportsmanship. The referees, and I must say to the referees, they need to understand that whether you're working a midget high school game or whether you're working the Mohawk College National Championship, Canadian Championship Final, or you're working the NBA Final, whoever you're working for, that game is the most important game in the lives of those players that are on the floor. Give 100%. As long as you're giving 100%, and the coaches see that you're given 100%, they should leave you alone. And I don't mean they get immunity from criticism. If they kick a call, the coach has a right to question that in a sportsmanlike manner with decorum. But I also tell the referees, you owe it whether you're working 12-year-olds or whether you're working the NCAA or the NBA, to give that game 100% of your effort, because you never know who's watching. And I'll give you an example. I went down to St. Catharines a couple of years ago with Guy Cipriani to watch a junior high school basketball game, because there was a young referee working that game that the people running the panel wanted me to and Sip to look at. That referee came out, gave 100%, and it was a junior high school basketball game. He treated that game like it was the NBA final. He had no idea that Sip and I were in the audience. We sat in the corner, and you know, that kid, we called the supervisor of officials for the OUA panel, and that young referee got hired. Now, little did he know at his age that he'd go out and work a junior high school basketball game, get seen, someone make a phone call and say, hey, we got somebody that's worth looking at, and he gets hired to work. So the bottom line there is, every game you go out to referee, every game you go out to coach, you deserve to give those players 100%. There's no nights off. And as a referee, I tell them, I got paid 75 cents to do my first game. That made me a professional because I was getting paid. So those kids deserved 100% effort.
I have two quick stories along the same lines. We hosted the national championships a couple years ago, and there was a referee, and I don't remember his name, I apologize, from Alberta, and he happened to be there, same thing. And the NBDL, the NBA Development League official evaluators were there, and yep, he ended up getting a call, and he works in the NBDL now. He went to the NBA camps in California, and now he's an official in the NBDL, and he didn't even, you know, he didn't even know that there were people there that day. So,
and he gave 100%.
And I, on the flip side, I had once, I got a technical up in Toronto in a tournament game there about a couple years ago as well. And we were winning by 40 points with 3 minutes left. And I got a technical and the reason was, I was really upset that we were at, if you want to call it, garbage time. Yeah. And I had kids in the game, and the other team had kids in the game that don't normally get to play a lot of minutes. And to me, the officials that day had kind of packed it in and like, oh, it's 40 points, let's get the hell out of here as fast as we can. And I didn't feel they were giving those kids who don't normally get an opportunity the proper officiating that they deserved, regardless of the score of the game.
Right.
So I got upset and I said, everybody deserves to be officiated. Stop wanting to go home and do the job for three more minutes, please.
Yeah, you know? I'm glad you told me that story. The kid gets in for 6 minutes a game deserves the same effort as the kid that gets in for 39 minutes a game.
Well, I've taken up a ton of your time here. We always end up our podcast on something that we call the full court press, and I ask you a series of questions that just... I'm just looking for one-word type answers, and I'd like to finish up with that if I could.
You bet, Brian. My pleasure.
All right, here we go. Do you prefer the FIBA rules or the Federation rules?
I grew up as a Federation, and I'm an old guy. Federation.
Are you able to watch a basketball game just for the enjoyment of the game, or are you always stuck on watching the officials?
Always watching the officials.
Favorite arena to do a game in?
Oh, Indiana. It used to be called Market Square, and it's had many, many names, but the new NBA arena in Indianapolis.
Most creative fan base.
That's easy, Duke.
Who's the most hostile fan base?
I would say Indiana. And I need to add that I once threw Bobby Knight out of a game in Bloomington, and it took the police 2 hours to get me out of the arena and back to my hotel in Indianapolis. And Bobby and I are friends.
Do you prefer the NBA or the college game?
College.
And what do you miss most about doing high-level games?
Oh, I miss the locker room. I miss the locker room, the guys. The guys in the locker room. You know what I remember? Everyone says to me, what's your favorite game? I've had a lot of games. And I always give them this answer: the privilege of doing the next one.
I think that's probably a great way to end it. For all your successes, I mean, with your Fox 40 whistle, we didn't even talk about that today, but obviously, you know, the inventor of the Fox 40 whistle, which is used in all leagues now, NFL, NBA, I mean, right across the board, to also being the chairman and CEO of Fluke Transportation Group, a member of the Canadian Basketball Hall of Fame. I mean, listening to you over the last 40 minutes, it's not hard to see why you've risen to the heights that you have in those areas. And I can't thank you enough for taking some time with me today.
Coach, it's my pleasure. Thanks for everything you're doing for the game of basketball. And yes, 2017, Fox 40 is 30 years old and Fluke Transport's 97 years old.
Wow. Well, I wish you all the best with both of those and in everything else that you get involved with.
Thanks, Coach. It's my pleasure.
All right. Take care, Ron.
There you have it. Aside from the fact that Ron Foxcroft is a fantastic speaker and successful ref, he's a great person too. The intent of this conversation was to help you appreciate the referee's point of view and help build your understanding of all the moving parts of a basketball game. Referees are people. They make mistakes. To expect perfection is unrealistic and only fuels frustration and anger, which lead you to not doing as good of a job as you should be doing as a coach and a leader. As we talk about in our basketball coaching roadmap, it's important to be self-aware as a coach. Analyze your relationships with referees. Are you adding a positive component, or are there areas you need to work on? Be honest with yourself, and if required, make it something you focus on in 2017. Did this episode remind you of a coach you've had or a basketball experience you've shared with someone? If so, we'd love to hear about it. You can go to coachcallstimeout.com/stories to share your story. We're looking for stories about coaches who are creating fantastic memories for their players. Help give them the recognition that they deserve and possibly get their story told on this podcast. Again, you can go to coachcallstimeout.com/stories to share your story. If you enjoyed what you heard, we'd appreciate it if you could rate us on iTunes or give us a review. Or you can share this episode with a friend or a coach by going to coachcallstimeout.com/23. We'll be back again in 2 weeks to pick the brain of another great coach. But before we go, if you listened to episode 20 with Coach Steve Konchalski, you know that he's a Hall of Fame basketball coach who's been coaching for over 40 years. In that episode, he shares some great stories. He has so many stories that we made it a segment on the show. And here's the latest installment of Storytime with Coach K. Enjoy.
This one goes back, and I can't really pick a year. I want to say it was early 80s. And we're at the Pinky Lewis tournament, which now I believe is a high school tournament, hosted by McMaster University. You'd be familiar with that, of course.
Correct.
First night we're playing McMaster, the host team. And the game goes into overtime, and we lose a heartbreaker at the buzzer. So I didn't feel we got a particularly good whistle on that night. So as the officials were leaving the floor, I had a few choice words for them. This was after the game. You know, to the effect of, you know, coming up to Ontario and getting a bad deal and, I was questioning their integrity. I was putting out weight perhaps a little bit more than I should have. Anyway, next day, you know, in the consolation third place game, we're playing York University, coached by the great Bob Bain, Hall of Fame coach, you know, coached over 30 years in the CIS and had some wonderful, you know, teams. Bob Bain had just been recovering from a serious auto accident and he was on crutches. Anyway, we're getting ready for the warm-ups for that game, and I look up, and who's walking into the gym are the same three officials that we had the night before that I was less than kind to at the end of the game. So I turned to my assistant coach and says, we're dead. We have no chance today. This is not going to happen. We're not going to get a call all night. Fortunately for us, and unfortunately for Bob Bain and New York Lions, we got every call, and it was ridiculous. We got more calls than we deserved. in that particular game. And again, everything was going our way. So Bane, of course, has got the crutch, he said, and he was so upset in the second half that he threw his crutch onto the floor. And they gave him a technical. Anyway, the game goes on, and nothing seemed to change. We seem to be getting all the calls. A few minutes later, he takes the other crutch, throws the other crutch on the floor. Second technical. He's ejected for the game. We win the game. So it's not a very pleasant story for Bob Bane, but I thought it was quite comical in the sense of every coach has their battles with officials. You never know what's going to happen from night to night, but whatever strategy worked for us that time, and we came away with the win.